Every country in the Eastern Bloc has a huge challenge today, and that is how to remake their society from a socialist society into a capitalist society. The Czech Republic in particular has an enormous challenge in front of it. Approximately 3% of the Czech economy was produced by the private sector in 1991, and they have to figure out a way to become capitalists, and their window is probably short.
Not capitalists. They were capitalists before, but they were state capitalists. They have to find a way to be based on private property.
I agree. And how do you transform your society entirely from top to bottom when you have so little private capitalism, when there are no laws or institutions or accountants to give you all the combinations and productivities of a capitalist society, a private capitalist society? And so the Czechs have been involved in this fascinating process of creating the rules, creating the institutions, and making the political reforms necessary to move this process along. It's enormously complicated. When you think about
they've all been involved in this. Poland, Hungary, mm-hmm. every one of them.
Yeah. And
but the Czechs have probably, I think we would all agree, have probably done a better job.
And with a different model.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, according right now to the privatization ministry in the Czech Republic, they're going to have over 80% of the economy in private hands by the end of 1994. Now that is shock therapy.
That's a remarkable transition in 3 years.
Do you think is it going to happen?
They're well on the way.
It's happening. It's happening. And in fact, the political coalition that wants to make it happen is firmly in power. The socialist opposition is in disarray and has no program. And the people that are running that show, in fact, from the top down, Prime Minister Václav Klaus, who calls himself, with some modesty, the Milton Friedman of Czechoslovakia, are very much committed to this program and, in fact, have every opportunity to do it. So it'll be fascinating to see how it comes out. But they're in a situation where, in privatizing these companies, they don't even know what the assets are. They don't know what the companies own, okay. what their debts are, and who really controls those assets. And the government really had very little information in a socialist economy mm-hmm. where the government owned everything and made all those rules. And so they have set some priorities that seem to be remarkably successful now in getting this process moving to successful completion. And if you ask anybody in the government there what their three priorities are, they'll all tell you speed, speed, speed. That this thing has to be done fast while the momentum for reform is politically powerful and before the forces of reaction have set in. And they're proceeding on that premise. With a couple of footnotes, of course. They want to give people a stake. The average common voter in that society is going to have a stake in this reform directly, and they want to also establish respect for the rule of law to get assets out of the hands of arbitrary political judgments as fast as they can.
Going back to the first, to giving a people a stake, I would say their philosophy is a little different. It comes to the same result.
Mm-hmm.
They said to themselves, we've got these so-called state enterprises. Who owns the enterprises? The people. Well, then let's give it to the people. Instead of the people owning it collectively, let's give it to the people individually.
Mm-hmm.
But they said, we don't really want to give it to the people and make them think they're getting something for nothing. And so we'll charge them a nominal price for it. And so they gave each one of them a book of vouchers and they made them pay.
They had to buy the book of vouchers.
They had to buy it.
Right.
But nonetheless, it was an enormous bargain.
Yeah. Well, for about $30, you could buy the voucher book, and now that the shares in the first wave of privatization for the large-scale industry has proceeded, and they're trading those shares, it's over $600 in market value. So it's not a lot by Western standards, but it's a lot more than you got under socialism.
It's 20-1. That's not a bad
That's
return.
A high rate of return, you're right.
Tom, how does this work out with the problem of picking up on Milton's point? Who gets them? Or is there a monopoly, a private monopoly element being created here as well, or is the voucher system decentralizing the ownership fairly well?
Yeah, that's a very important point because so much of what we've seen in privatization in the West, particularly in England,
mm-hmm.
Has been privatization of monopolies, which has been about a halfway success because you haven't eliminated all the barriers that you should. The Czechs have actually gone the other way, and they have purposely broken up monopolies when they privatized them. They had a dairy cartel that they essentially broke up, construction cartel, And this has been very important in terms of bringing more competition in.
And in terms of the initial thing, every citizen of the Czech Republic was entitled to buy one of these voucher books.
Mm-hmm. And then you have...
And 70% of the population did.
In other countries, and I trust this is true in your experience as well, there's also the problem of what we're trying to break up is this sort of conglomerate, if you will, of cross-subsidies and all different kinds of activities. Yeah, it's not just a railroad. It's a railroad that did all sorts of other things.
Well, it's amazing. The government under the socialist regime did not know what firms owed what other firms what monies, because there's no bankruptcy in socialism. Mm-hmm. And so if a company borrows money from another firm and don't pay them back, who's going to foreclose? They just don't pay them back. And there are all these kinds of relationships and contracts or quasi-contracts that have to be somehow discovered and dealt with. And that's enormously complicated. Now, the thing that they've done in the Czech Republic really has some genius to it. Milton got to one aspect of that, and that is what's called voucher privatization, where they sold these voucher books and he used those as a citizen to buy these shares, which turned out to be very profitable for the public. But only about half of the large-scale industry is actually being turned over in the voucher scheme.
Let's go back for a moment. As I understand it, the Czech Republic classified their state enterprises in three groups. Small ones, which they auctioned off in a whole series of auctions, and simply individual Czechs or groups of Czechs bought it.
This was in the local areas, about 27,000 small businesses like printing shops and restaurants and a dry cleaner or something like that.
Then they had the intermediate size, those which say went through the voucher system. Then they have the very large size, which are in very poor shape, in which they didn't really want to load on the people.
What?
They're white elephants.
Yeah, what are they going to do with these white elephants?
Well, right now, some of the white elephants are going to the people, actually, Milton, and that's one of the interesting things about this. The overall scheme is got an element of brilliance to it. Here the government wants to give away these enterprises, just get them out in the private sector, get entrepreneurs making decisions rather than bureaucrats. They don't know how to define the companies, let alone how to assign ownership to private stockholders. So how do you do this? What they did is they essentially came up with a competitive process that goes in two waves for what they call large-scale privatization. During these waves, the privatization ministry has a very short window of about 3 months where it accepts applications, proposals, to privatize a list of a couple thousand companies put together by the privatization ministry, and anybody can write a proposal on how to privatize this company, this state company. A foreign citizen could write a proposal and say, I want to buy the company. A member of the government or a worker at the enterprise can say, you ought to give away some of the shares to the workers and then put the rest in the voucher privatization scheme. So there are all kinds of combinations of ownership you can do. But in each of these applications, what you have to do, first of all, is define the assets. You have to research who owns it. There's no title company. There's no place you can go up and look who owns the company. You have to address restitution issues, because they do give restitution if a family can prove that they have resided in the Czech Republic and get this back from when it was expropriated by the communists in 1948. And then you have to talk about how you're going to privatize a company, if you're going to pay for it or going to go to vouchers or whatnot. And finally, you have to describe what this new privatized company would do, who's going to work there, what products it's going to make. And the bureaucrats at the privatization ministry get several competitive proposals. And based upon how well these proposals do in terms of defining ownership and in terms of dedicating that company to building something productive, almost on a homesteading or pioneering principle, they award ownership rights based on these plans and this competitive bidding process. Now, this has had a mark of genius to it, because instead of having bureaucrats in Prague try to figure all this stuff out, they have the private sector and the public.
It goes right to the heart of why governments fail, because governments aren't able to put this information together. And so what you've done is you say, okay, we're going to have this competition, and the information is generated. So the genius of it is, as you're pointing out, is that you're using the private market to create the private market.
Absolutely. And because you have very short windows, and you tell people they've got 3 months to submit these proposals, instead of people going out and politically campaigning against you and saying, no, it's not fair, the Social Democrats think it's a terrible scheme, what you do is you get everybody racing to fill out these proposals and try to get in on the privatization, and particularly the apparatchiks. These are the guys with the inside information, so they're writing these proposals like gangbusters, trying to do everything they can to get some ownership shares out of this. And in fact, it's a great way to buy them off, because the only way they can get in on the goodies now is to participate in the private sector.
How do you work the capital markets into this? What's happening in the capital markets? Is there enough internal savings to do these sorts of things?
Well, a lot of it.
There's a valuation problem here and a financing problem. You're nodding your head no here.
There's no financing problem for those things that are distributed
just given away
vouchers.
Right. And that's a big help, because a lot of stuff, you just don't have a big demand for, say, a foreign buyer to come in, and so it goes into the voucher privatization scheme. But there are a lot of foreign buyers involved in these, and a lot of domestic and foreign partnerships that have submitted proposals, whether it be from Germans, Americans, Japanese.
And one important thing, unless I'm mistaken, there are no special advantages to foreigners. One of the big mistakes I believe that underdeveloped countries make, and that the states in the United States make, is to try to bribe people to come in mm-hmm. in their area, and that's a great mistake.
Yeah.
I think that the Czech Republic or Hungary or any of them ought to be prepared to sell things off to foreigners, but not at particularly advantageous terms.
Well, it was very interesting.
Not to subsidize them.
It was very interesting that many Western companies were very much opposed to the voucher privatization scheme. Now, of course, they wanted to come in and buy these state enterprises, but they didn't want to negotiate with stockholders. They wanted to negotiate with the state. The
Absolutely.
Bureaucrats take them out on the yacht, wine and dine, get it for a bargain.
As we've seen.
When I visited Hungary a few years ago, I had an afternoon cocktail party with a whole bunch of Western lawyers, accountants, and so on, who were there, and they were all negotiating with the government. None of them had any use for a voucher scheme. I ended up telling them that they were doing far more harm than they were good so far as Hungary was concerned.
That's right.
And as you may know, when Václav Klaus was in this country some time ago, and they asked him what we could do that would be most helpful to Czechoslovakia, he said, put an embargo on advisors.
The Václav Klaus, now maybe called Santa Klaus, really has given the Czech people a personal stake in this. And he's credible, because he said, look, you don't have to participate in voucher privatization. It's going to cost you about $30, and that's a lot for you people. But if you want to get in on it, come on in. They all, by the surveys and so forth, they estimated 2 million people would buy the booklets. Approximately 7 or 8 million people bought the booklets.
But you know why? You know why? Because some Czechs who were in the United States came over and organized mutual funds.
Well, there are a few of them, but there were over 400 mutual funds
That's
organized.
That's right.
And some of them were even organized by state banks and state insurance companies.
Now, the funds promised a certain amount of payback after the first phase.
Some of them did, some of them didn't.
And how's that going? I mean,
well,
are they making it?
Some of them are getting paid off right now. As a matter of fact, they're getting paid off more than the $600 in some cases.
Is Slovakia, we start out with Czechoslovakia, as you know, with this
right.
whole program. Is Slovakia is backing off from phase two, aren't they?
They've got political problems,
yeah.
And they are gradualists. They are people who want to debate about how these things should be privatized,
mm-hmm.
and we'll probably get back to them in 20 or 30 years to see how it's going. The Czechs are speeding ahead, and they're transforming their society virtually overnight with this kind of a thing.
And it's such a refreshing thing by comparison with what we see happening in Bosnia, with what we see happening in the some of the former Soviet states. It's such a refreshing thing to see the Czechs and the Slovak peacefully and decently and in a civilized way agreeing mm-hmm. to separate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the really the resurgence of commerce in Prague is visible, and just all kinds of success stories about how the transformation is going on. I was just there a couple weeks ago and interviewed a woman who was an anchor on the national news. And she quit 3 years ago to buy a small dress shop, in fact, create a small dress shop. There hadn't been anything selling upscale, she-she, Paris-type fashion in Prague. When she started out just 3 years ago, she said her biggest problem was that nobody knew how to do anything in the private sector. She had to hire an architect away from a state firm, and nobody knew how to get permits or clothes imported in the country. I said, "What's your biggest problem today?" In 1993, she says, "There are just too many of these dress shops out there now."
Choice and competition. Has Hungary been using the voucher scheme at all?
No, not to any extent like this. It's been more divesting from the central to the local governments and letting the local governments deal with these things. It's a totally different model. Mm-hmm. It's a model that, the Hungary believes that they're going to be a gradualist success.
Mm-hmm. They started gradualism 20 years ago.
25.
25 years ago, I'm sorry. What about Poland, Tom?
Well, the Poles, of course, went through the shock therapy with respect to the small business sector.
Yeah.
But with respect to large-scale industry, they have not made progress in privatization. And there is some considerable pride in the Czech Republic that there is no office of the World Bank in Prague, but there is one in Warsaw, because the Warsaw government has worked with the World Bank on a very different privatization scheme to try to create large investment funds and then have those basically invest on behalf of the public. The Czechs have gone from the bottom up. They've distributed the stock to the individuals, 8 million stockholders. And the stockholders themselves
What's
have
the
put their stock.
What's the population of
Czech Republic? Well, it was 15 million.
No, the Czech Republic.
10 million.
And so there are 8 million stockholders out of 10 million.
Well, some of those are Slovaks now.
I see.
But it was about 70% of the adult population.
Yeah.
And those people have put their shares in mutual funds. And right now there are over 200 major mutual funds that account for about three-fourths of the voucher shares. Most people, just as in this country, don't try to pick their stocks. And those mutual funds have become very powerful in terms of meeting with the managers of the companies and starting to redirect resources towards market-oriented production.
Where are we in terms of the whole restructuring and the next step once these activities become privatized? Sort of the technical restructuring and the financial restructuring, the labor management kind of restructuring.
You're in for wholesale changes. There's no question that many of these companies were producing things that nobody wanted. The Czechs obviously did a lot of arms production, even more in Slovakia, mm-hmm. and that business is fortunately dried up, particularly in the Eastern Bloc. But there has already been a drop of 6% employment in the industrial sector, which is over 40% of the Czech economy. Mm-hmm. But there's virtually no unemployment. Unemployment is still only 4%. Those people are going into the service sector, and obviously that was the underdeveloped part of the Czech economy. So there is a transformation that's going on. What people say is that this transformation will have to become much more brutal, that there will have to be wholesale layoffs, particularly when more of these large-scale industries go into the private sector. And so there may be some unemployment coming. But the thriving service sector so far has been picking up all that transitional labor.
Isn't one of their big problems a brown coal area?
Well, yeah, they have a lot of dirty, costly industrial production in that
and
country.
And very polluting.
Yeah, and so as soon as they clean up their act, they're gonna have a lot of costs to impose on themselves. This is the excesses of the material excesses of communism. And in fact, the city of Prague, being beautiful, has a terrible air pollution problem, which is quite sad. So there does have to be a lot of restructuring in all dimensions here.
It's been a fascinating thing to me that in the West, all of the so-called greens blame capitalism and business for pollution. Mm-hmm. But the worst pollution in the world is in these former socialist countries.
It's also, and we see this in a place like Romania, the pollution is bad and the waste is bad because without any of the kind of price signals and competitive processes set in place, a simple concept like maintenance of a business firm or even maintenance of a public facility simply was not part of what was done. It was more of an rather than seeing things as a process or a flow of services, it was asset accumulation.
Oh.
And then that had been worked on more asset accumulation. And now these assets are, as you described, many of them just white elephants.
Sure. Well, all through the socialist bloc, you see that there is tremendous inefficiency. And in these countries like Poland and Czechoslovakia, generally speaking, the rule of thumb is that they take three times as many inputs to produce an output as a Western country, and three times as much pollution.
But
just another input.
But there are two ways to interpret that.
Mm-hmm.
And one way is that it shows what tremendous opportunities are available.
Yes.
You've got such inefficient use of resources in these countries
yeah.
that it means that they have the opportunity for a tremendous growth in their level of living and their level of income.
I think you're looking at the Taiwan of Eastern Europe when you go to Prague.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I tell you, what's also healthy is, I mentioned the competition with, is in the economic sense. Even though Hungary is pursuing perhaps the gradualist approach, and by the way, they argue that, as you point out, the unemployment is yet to hit Czechoslovakia. These countries are also seeing a competition between themselves. The Hungarians are very proud of what they're doing. I sit in the polls, and the Czechs, this is one of the great things about the system breaking up as it did. We're going to have different experiments, and we know from our Western experiment that's a good thing.
Well, we'll see how the Milton Friedman of Czechoslovakia does.
Well, no, but it's good that they should have pride in what they're doing.
Yeah, it is.
You
yeah,
want them to have a feeling of accomplishment and achievement, and they can learn from one another, and they will. But they won't say they've learned from one another.
No. Well, I don't think most Western countries. Not too many Americans say, I learned something from the French the other day, right?
No, they certainly
don't say that very often.
No, I'm afraid not. People really, fundamentally, only learn from their own mistakes. Yeah. It's a very rare case when you learn from somebody else's mistakes.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, they're making also a lot of the mistakes that are very familiar to us here in the United States. When I was in Prague, for example, I talked with members of the Broadcasting Commission, and they had just awarded one private TV station license for the entire country. One license.
Oh, my gosh.
And I've served as chief economist of the Federal Communications Commission, and I was interested in this question. And I asked them, why only one? I thought you were a liberal country. And they said, well, for technical reasons, you can only have one.
Nonsense.
And I said, well, you know, in the U.S., we actually allocated spectrum for 82 stations. And if you go to Rome today, you can even see 40 off-the-air TV stations. I said, I haven't done any atmospheric tests here in the Czech Republic, but I'd imagine if you're like the rest of the planet, mm-hmm. you've got room for a little competition. But of course, there's a lot of the same political dynamic to always restrict entry into the market. And the United States has a long history of doing this in TV and trying to stop cable competition and all the rest. So in some cases, they're just where we were in 1952 or 1962.
The other kind of atmosphere is going to happen is that those Western stations are going to beam into the Czech Republic, and it's going to be another King Canute problem where you simply aren't going to be able to stop this.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully.
But again, the hopeful thing about this is that the inefficiency of the former system is so great that the new system can make great progress, even though they have very inefficient sectors, like the television sector or like some of these other sectors. It's not a case where you've got to squeeze the last drop out. That isn't the problem. The problem is you've got a system which has been producing about a third as much, or maybe a quarter as much, as a system is really capable of producing.
Sure. So
if you can just go up to 75%, right. You've done very well.
If you make just large mistakes instead of huge mistakes.
That's right.
Much better.
Well, then you must be encouraged by the United States, because we're headed this way where we can correct all these inefficiencies in 20 years.
Oh, absolutely, I am. Here in the United States, less than half the resources are really used by the private system. And yet, we've had tremendous material progress with less than half the resources. Mm-hmm. We have the highest standard of living in the world. Now just think what we could have done if we could use all those resources.
All those resources.
United States is not an example.
No, I was, I thought you'd appreciate that comment.
I gave a lecture in Poland some years ago in which the title was, the United States is not the model for Poland.
Well, you
I may say I gave that under the auspices of the USIS.
you must not have thought 5 years ago that we'd be sitting here talking about this today.
No, I certainly did not, and there's nobody in the world who did. Mm-hmm. You find it very hard. I suppose you have to give credit where credit is due. In 1984 or 5, Ronald Reagan gave a speech in which he said that the Soviet Union is so inefficient that it is going to collapse.
Well, that's a great question. So why was the Western world so shocked? I mean, if we really believe these markets work, why were we so taken aback? Did we maybe not believe our own rhetoric?
Only economists believe that the market works. The rest of them, markets prevail and exist, not because people believe they work, but because they haven't got anything better. And because the market is so efficient that it will creep into whatever corners you leave open for it. and take over.
So that suggests that we shouldn't have been perhaps that surprised. But it's important to see where this is going.
Yeah.
We'll get back here in a few days, and a few weeks, a few years, and see how the second phase is going to go.
Well, I don't know how efficient we've been in our discussion, but we certainly hit on some fascinating things that are happening around the world. And we'll have to bring this discussion to a happy conclusion and talk about it more in the future.